Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. I'd like to welcome our live audience here in San Francisco and our radio and online audiences. It's my great pleasure to introduce Dr. George Lundberg, the founder of the Lundberg Institute, who is going to moderate tonight's event.
Thank you very much, George. Thank you all for coming. I'm Dr. George Lundberg. I'm president and chairman of the board of the Lundberg Institute. This is the fifth annual lecture of the Lundberg Institute, all given with the collaboration of the Commonwealth Club. On behalf of the board of directors of the Institute and its chief financial officer, the other Dr. Lundberg, would you please stand up and I welcome you here. First, disclosures. I'm also a consulting professor at Stanford, and one of my chairs, Dr. Henderson, is expected. Are you here, Dr. Henderson? Perhaps he'll come in a little later. I'm executive advisor at Curious, which we call medical publishing beyond open access. And Mr. Mark Arnold of Curious is to be here. Again, perhaps he'll appear a bit later. I'm an editor-at-large for Medscape, and I'm chief medical officer at Collabrex in San Francisco, a company that provides applied oncogenomics, and our CEO, Mr. Tom Mica, and his wife are here. Okay. Tonight's program is based upon a very recent report of the Institute of Medicine of the National Academies of Medicine, Science, and Engineering. It's actually just been published on September 22nd of this year. And its title is Improving Diagnosis in Healthcare. We have the good fortune tonight of having three members of the Committee of 21 who wrote the report as speakers. They are Elizabeth McGlynn here, who is director of the Center for Effectiveness and Safety Research at Kaiser Permanente, stationed in Pasadena. We have also, get my papers here, Catherine McDonald, Executive Director of the Center for Health Policy and the Center for Primary Care and Outcomes Research at Stanford, and Irma Mala Sarkar, Associate Professor of Medicine at UC San Francisco. Also with us from Washington, D.C. is Aaron Below, who was a principal staff person for the committee, who perhaps more than anyone else actually made this report a reality. She looks very mild, but my guess is that she cracks the whip very nicely. Now, everybody knows about therapeutic errors in medicine that kill somewhere around 400,000 Americans a year, a chronic problem and highly resistant to solutions. The IOM report in 2001 called "To Err is Human" is a bulwark of the patient safety movement. Now we're 14 years later. How about errors in diagnosis? Do they matter? My old medical school professor, Tinsley Harrison, of Harrison's textbook fame, taught us that patients don't care about diagnoses, they care about symptoms. Maybe with the internet, that's no longer true, I'm not sure. But regardless of patients, who cares about diagnoses? I would say physicians, life insurance companies, coding clerks, payers of medical costs, employers, public health officials, biostatisticians, pharmaceutical and medical device companies, hospitals, medical schools, marketing and advertising industries, family members, public relations agents, philanthropies, school health nurses, medical research funders, medical associations, journal editors, the public media, undertakers, and underwriters. They all care about diagnoses, and they all care for their own particular reasons, which they think are important. Dr. Mark Graber, who was also a member of the committee, as I understand, has recently written that errors in diagnosis may be more frequent and can be more harmful than errors in treatment. Indeed, there's now a whole new medical association that Mark founded called the Society to Improve Diagnosis in Medicine. And it has its own journal called Diagnosis. No one knows absolute medical truth. Diagnoses are simply convenient labels to attach to descriptions of perceptions. Diagnoses act as abbreviated shortcuts intended to convey quickly a common understanding of pathophysiologic processes and signaling prognosis. What are the definitional benchmarks, the gold standards against which chosen diagnoses are measured? Questions like, what is the diagnosis? And the obligate follow-up, how do you know? And the real killer questions, why does it matter? And what do we do now? Of course, making accurate diagnoses in really sick people who die and are not autopsied is a blind man's or a blind system's folly. On that happy note, let's go to our speakers. They will be in the order in which I introduce them. Dr. Beth McGlynn will give an overview of the whole report. Then Kathy McDonald will talk from the patient's perspective. And Irma Mala-Sarkar will talk from the primary care physician's perspective.
Okay, thanks, George, for that introduction and for the opportunity to be here to discuss this report from the Institute of Medicine called Improving Diagnosis in Healthcare. As George mentioned, this report is really the next installment in the Quality Chasm series. In 1999, Taeris Human alerted the American public that safety was a major issue, and a lot of people were unaware of that. And it really had in it a call to action to address safety problems in the U.S. healthcare system. That was followed in 2001 by the report Crossing the Quality Chasm, which raised people's awareness that the quality of medical care was not as good as many people believed it was, and laid out a vision for a multidimensional way of thinking about quality that really has set the tone for a lot of measurement going forward. The focus of both of these reports is primarily, as George mentioned, on treatment. And in many cases, the assumption has been that diagnosis is done correctly and we can just proceed to pay attention to problems with treatment. What we hope to do with the report on diagnostic error is, again, raise attention of the American people that diagnostic error is a significant concern and that there are steps that can be taken to improve it. The committee was 20 members with quite broad expertise, including a variety of different medical specialties, measurement experts, human factors engineers, nurses, lawyers, economists, and a variety of other specialties. This particular slide highlights in red the three of us that are talking to you today, along with Aaron, the study director, who was truly amazing in getting this work done. The study was had 10 sponsors. It was initiated by the Society to Improve Diagnosis in Medicine, SIDM, that George mentioned. And I think the interesting thing, if you look at the sponsors here, is it really reflects the breadth of engagement that will be necessary to address the problem. So it reflects really a lot of the stakeholders who are absolutely key to solving this problem. The committee had the following charge. The first was to evaluate quality of care, evaluate diagnostic error within the context of quality of care, which means that we were really trying to think about excellence, not just avoiding error. And in fact, that was what led to the report title, focusing on improving diagnosis in healthcare. The second charge had to do with taking a look at the nature, extent, and causes of the problem. And the third part of the charge was recommending solutions across a wide variety of areas. So the key themes from the report are that diagnostic errors are a significant and underappreciated healthcare quality challenge, that patients are really central to the solution, and that diagnosis itself is a collaborative effort. I think all too often we think about sort of Marcus Welby sitting in his office, making it all up in his head, and a lot of the work that the committee did tried to reflect how much this is a much larger effort, and I'll try to underscore that with some of the next few slides. So in order to talk about a topic, you have to define what you're talking about, diagnostic error. And it turns out that there's really was a remarkable lack of consensus in the field among those who were writing and publishing on this topic. So the committee took a look at those definitions and really concluded that for our own purposes, we were going to have to come up with our own definition. And it was important to us to focus on the patient because, in fact, it is the patient who experiences the consequences of a diagnostic error. So the definition is in two parts. The first is that it is the failure to establish an accurate and timely explanation of the patient's health problem. A couple of things here, and I'll try to emphasize those as we go along. We used the term health problem for the reasons that George kind of highlighted, which is it's more than just a label. It's more than just a diagnosis. It's really an explanation to the patient about what's going on and what that means for where we should go from here. And so we really deliberately picked that term. I'm going to talk about accuracy and timeliness as something that doesn't just happen at a point in time, but rather evolves over time. But the sense of this is not... it is not that there is that we can always define how long it takes, but that it should be as quickly as possible to reach an appropriate conclusion. The second part of the definition is that we need to communicate that explanation to the patient, and we involve the family in a lot of these discussions as well. Patients are really central to the solution. They have to be a part of the whole journey along the way, and so that is why we called out this communication as a separate component of diagnostic error. So as part of the committee's process, we developed a conceptual framework to guide our thinking, and this is an eye test. You won't actually be able to read it. But let me just try to hit some highlights here. The first is it starts with a patient experiencing a health problem. And then you'll notice there's sort of a break. So the second box means that not everybody who experiences a health problem makes a connection to the healthcare system. And we thought it was important to highlight that sometimes that's where things go south. Then, you know, let's assume that some people engage with the healthcare system. The circle reflects the diagnostic process. So there's a part where we're gathering information from a variety of sources, history, physical exam, diagnostic testing, sometimes referral and consultation with other health professionals. That information is integrated and interpreted, and you come up with a working diagnosis. And then sometimes that doesn't quite seem to be it, and you go around the circle again and again. And then at some point, there is an explanation for the problem, and you shoot out to the communication of what that diagnosis is, what that problem is, and that explanation is, we hope, communicated to the patient. That then becomes the basis for treatment, which is the next to the last chevron there, and then that in turn leads to outcomes. So the main takeaway from this is that there are a lot of moving parts in the diagnostic process. It's iterative, it happens over time, and this tells you a little bit about the challenges of trying to address the problem. Now, if that weren't complicated enough, here is the next part of the conceptual framework. And what I want to highlight for you are two things. One is that we've added a box here that is the work system. So what we recognized is that the diagnostic process occurs within what we called a work system, and that means all of the people who are on the team who are trying to make the diagnosis, including the patient, the tasks that they're all undertaking, the technologies and tools that they're using, the organization within which this is occurring, the physical environment, the external environment like payment and medical liability. So all of that creates this environment. I think of it as almost like a factory within which diagnosis is being undertaken. And so really understanding that process becomes a part of understanding the opportunities to make solutions. And then what we see is the outcomes that are produced. And The first one, an accurate and timely diagnosis, that's what we're going for. But the second one includes both diagnostic errors and near misses. And both of these things we think are things that we can learn from. And in fact, this framework was really designed to say, let's understand the process and then let's find ways to learn from all of these component parts along the way. And then I'll say again, I think if you just stare at the diagram a minute, you'll say, wow, it's complicated. And I think that's exactly right. This is not a simple process, and I don't think we want to take away from the complexity of what's required. So ideally, what we, the committee, would have loved to have had, and I will tell you, I spent a lot of time trying to make this be show, is you would like to know the number of times every year there's an opportunity to make a diagnosis. If we could just have a count of how many times at bat we have to try to make a diagnosis, and then we could count how many times we do it in a timely and accurate manner. That would be, you know, one number. And then we also could count how many times that explanation was communicated to the patient. That's what we'd love to have. The reality is the evidence base today really didn't allow us to do that. Now, we had a lot of evidence to take a look at. And, you know, what we see is that some of the most reliable estimates come from autopsy studies, from medical record review, from malpractice claims. But what all of these things have in common is that an adverse event occurred, an unexplained death, an unexpected visit, a serious diagnosis like a late-stage cancer, a malpractice claim, and that event, that adverse event, led somebody to examine the trail that led to that and draw a conclusion that diagnostic error played some role in how we ended up there. And the problem is that it's kind of like a jigsaw puzzle. We don't know how representative any of those adverse events are. We don't know how much they reflect the sort of whole set of things that go on in the healthcare system. And we don't know how representative what happened to those cases we were able to examine are. And so it made it very difficult for us to come up with a point estimate or a range of how often diagnostic errors occur in this country every year. But we did recognize from looking at the evidence that it was likely that most of us would experience a diagnostic error sometime during our lifetime, and that many of those errors would have devastating consequences. And so I think what we tried to say is we can't give you a number, people would love a number, but we can tell you this is something that may well touch you and touch you in a serious way. I'm being hacked. Okay. All right. Whatever. So from looking at the evidence and on the underlying causes and risks, the committee concluded that we needed a broader focus on improving diagnosis, not just trying to eliminate errors. And the recommendations that the committee made were organized around 8 broad goals. What I'm going to try to do is to sort of stay at pretty much the high level of those goals to give you a sense of the breadth of the report, and then Kathy and Irma Mala will sort of dig into some of those a bit more specifically. So the first goal is about teamwork, and it recognized the need for the full range of healthcare professionals and patients to be involved and to have the knowledge, skills, resources, and frankly, the practice in working together as a team to arrive at an accurate and timely diagnosis. And so we talk a lot about the various players that need to be involved in making sure that we are treating diagnosis as a team and a collaborative endeavor. The second goal, and not surprisingly, is to look at the education system and make sure that we are providing healthcare professionals with the kind of education and training they need to play in this collaborative team sport. And we highlight some very specific areas, such as clinical reasoning and awareness of cognitive processes and cognitive biases, communication skills. This is something that actually often gets called out in the quality of care area. The appropriate use of diagnostic tests, just to name a few of the areas that we very specifically called out as really needing to be a much more central part of health professional training. And we talk about about the need to assess these competencies not only at the time of training, but throughout the life course, the career course of an individual. The third goal is to ensure that the health information technologies are really there to support the diagnostic process. I think in the report we recognize that technology is both part of the problem and part of the solution. And we invoked many of the recommendations from a 2011 IOM report on health information technology and patient safety and said, a lot of those things still haven't been done. We sort of re-emphasize the need to implement those recommendations. This part of the report also calls for much better engagement with the vendors of these products today for both an evaluation of those products, paying attention to a lot of human factors issues, understanding better how they fit within clinical workflows, and trying to reflect user-centered design. So there's a lot of design principles that from the human factors area that we highlight as important and kind of largely missing in those technologies. We also talk about the need for an ability to have a free and open conversation about what is working and what's not working with those tools and call on HHS and the Office of the National Coordinator for Health Information Technology to help in this journey of bringing these products into alignment with a sort of safer and better care delivery process. The fourth goal is the one I think of as the sort of all-in. So as I showed in the conceptual framework, the committee recognized the importance of work systems. Those systems are just by their nature local. And what that means is that we need sort of everybody locally paying attention to this issue. And we need to emphasize learning through the identification of errors, feedback to health professionals about when those errors have occurred. We learned that often people don't even know that an error happened because the right diagnosis was made by somebody else and that loop is never closed. Through ongoing monitoring, we call out a specific role for specialty societies. And this is the area where we call on HHS to designate a subset of health systems to routinely conduct post-mortem examinations. So some of those inability to understand and provide estimates about the problem and really understand some of the things we need to get a good picture on that we can really get from autopsies. We think that's going to take a concerted funding and a concerted effort. The fifth goal is about having a work system and a culture that emphasizes and supports the diagnostic process. So for those local systems, we highlight some of the essentials of what does and doesn't work. We think you need a non-punitive culture, which is essential for learning. We need ways to engage patients and families, both in the process and in developing solutions and being part of the conversations when errors occur about how that can be prevented in the future. We need systems that enable communication among team members. And one of the things that we call it in particular is something called error recovery. That is, to really have ways of catching things before they go any further. Kaiser Permanente has a system, for example, in Southern California called SureNet, which is sort of routinely looking for things that might have been missed so that we can try to catch them before they go too far. The sixth goal reflects, I'll say the committee came to the conclusion that it was premature to, and we actually thought it was probably counterproductive, to call for public reporting or the use of financial rewards or penalties around diagnostic error. There are a lot of challenges with measuring and really being sure that we've accurately identified these things. And so we call on HHS in particular to help with the development of more effective voluntary reporting systems. We particularly look to the patient safety organizations that have been created because they have the right sort of legal infrastructure to do this work, although we, I think, call on an evaluation to make sure they're up for the challenge. We call out the need to pay attention to the legal environment. Again, this is an area where we looked at the evidence and we couldn't say, here's exactly the right way to go. So we call out the need for demonstration projects to try out administrative health courts and some other alternatives to our current approaches to medical malpractice, which don't seem to be effective either in protecting patients or in preventing adverse events. The seventh set goal has to do with payment, and I think it's important to say that although payment isn't the problem, we think we see diagnostic errors in a variety of different systems with a variety of different payment methods. There are a number of observations about things with the current fee-for-service payment structure that we think certainly don't help with contributing to an environment that enables excellence in diagnosis and that distort the care delivery process. Some specific examples are to develop codes that would cover radiology and pathology consults, for example. There's nothing right now in the payment system that pays for the time that it takes for those team members to really be a part of discussions around diagnosis. We call for a greater weight for the value of the evaluation and management codes, what I think of as the talking to patients. In almost every area of quality that we look at, I have to say this need for more time for patients and doctors to have a chance to have a conversation is a key feature, and we call on the need to make sure that we have our payment systems aligned with that need. And we also call for modifications to current documentation guidelines that really we think get in the way of making sure that the electronic health record or even a written health record is an accurate reflection of what's going on with the patient. So there are a number of things that I think we think in the documentation area could be improved. Finally, I think in looking at the evidence, we recognize that the diagnostic era is a very nascent field of endeavor, and there are no natural funders for this work. So we called for investments in research and learning. We called on the federal government to come together and create an integrated effort and provide dedicated funding for study in this area, and also the need for public-private collaboration to develop learning systems where we can take advantage of the local experience, but make sure that that's translated back to the nation. So in conclusion, the committee found that that it was possible to improve the diagnostic process. As complicated as it is, we saw a lot of pathways to get there. It's not only possible, but we thought it represented a moral, professional, and public health imperative. We think in order to get there, we're going to have to re-envision the whole way that we do diagnosis today, and we're going to have to get everybody, as I said, an all-in approach to committing to making the changes that are necessary. So, and that's just, you can download the report, and I will turn it to Kathy.
Thank you, Beth. That was a wonderful overview. I have some slides to...
Oh, I should have.
Are all the slides from the report?
The
complicated chart is that.
Yeah, that's in the report. Yeah, the chart. And you could probably read it if you actually see it in the report. Sorry.
Hello. So I want you to consider this question. Can patients themselves improve diagnosis and prevent diagnostic error? This is important because the committee said it was important to consider the patient perspective. The report basically says that patients and patient advocates are crucial to being able to implement the recommendations that flow from the goals that Beth McGlynn just covered. The report also concludes that leveraging the expertise, the power, and the influence of the patient community will help spur progress. But I would assert that we're unlikely to actually get progress unless we have this kind of all-in situation, and particularly that we have the patient community, the public, actively engaged in this improvement game. Now, it's not exactly a game, it's actually a very serious topic, but I like games, and I think that they provide a helpful analogy. Games involve the benefits of strategy, they usually are relatively accessible, So we're looking at a complex issue, but it's helpful to try to break it down. I mean, in games, there's rules, and there's a lot of players usually, or there's a possibility for that. So it's an analogy that we could draw from as we look for clues in terms of how to help patients engage in a way that can help tackle this issue and have the public be more engaged in this issue. So I hope that through hearing a little bit more from the patient perspective and what Beth has shared and what Irma Mala will be sharing, that you'll be interested in looking at the report more in detail, some of the more specific recommendations, because it's a bit of a playbook. It's a playbook of sorts, kind of the beginning of a set of rules by which we might think about playing this game. And if we want to really work on this issue, we have to play to win. To really look at the issue of diagnosis, it helps to have stories. And I wanted to start with two stories. So a young man, a 17-year-old boy, went to the emergency room by himself in January of 2005. He was complaining of severe pain in his left ankle. He has worked up, tests were done, and the doctor ultimately said that he thought that it was probably just a twisted ankle and that the boy hadn't realized when he'd twisted it and it would be fine to go home and he'd get better. The boy thought the doctor understood the whole situation, knew, and decided not to complain about his pain anymore. Several months later, the boy was rushed to the emergency room with severely labored breathing. Imaging showed cancer in his ankle and his lungs. He had Ewing sarcoma, which is a fast-moving pediatric cancer, and he underwent treatment for a year. Several months later, the cancer had gone away, and several months later it came back, and soon after his 18th birthday, he passed away. At diagnosis, he had a 30% chance of survival because the cancer had already spread to his lungs. During the same month of the same year, a teenage girl went to the emergency room with her mother. She was complaining of severe pain in her left knee. Again, the doctor did tests, checked her out, and said that there wasn't anything to explain the pain. She'd probably bumped her knee on the soccer field and just didn't remember. She objected to the assessment, and her mother asked what to do about the pain. The doctor wrote a prescription for a narcotic. Just a few weeks later, the mother called the pediatrician, who referred them to an orthopedic doctor, who ordered an MRI, which showed a tumor in her tibia. Her lungs were checked and clear. She also underwent treatment for a year for Ewing sarcoma. She met the boy in the hospital. They became friends. 7 years later, the girl remains cancer-free. At diagnosis, she had a 70% chance of survival because the fast-moving cancer had not spread to the lungs. So here's the challenge. If you see a piece of a game, which game does it go to? If you see symptoms, do you know what the disease a person has? Matching the pieces to the correct game is easier when all the pieces are there and when you know the game. In the emergency room setting, doctors are focusing on figuring out whether the patient has a disease that is immediately life-threatening. The problem in both these stories is the second part of the definition, the explanation part. Neither teenager was told an explanation that had to do with what the limits of the diagnostic search had been, and therefore what might need to happen afterwards if the pain persisted. So this would be, according to our definition, a failure, a diagnostic error failure, because the communication wasn't complete enough to help the patient know what they needed to do about their health problem. Another part of the story is that the boy who had the diagnosis that took longer and had severe consequences went to the emergency room alone in the first case. The girl went to the emergency room with her mother. So when there's somebody who can be a patient advocate, who can know the patient well, there's more of a chance, perhaps, of a timely diagnosis. This happens outside of the medical care system and points to the, the issue of social determinants of health may be applying to diagnostic safety as well. So we need to think about this problem in many, many layers to understand what we can do. And we can learn a lot from patients' stories. Those were just two. Institute of Medicine, in the release of the report, also put out a video with three people who tell their stories, both of diagnosis going awry and of diagnosis going smoothly. We can learn from all of these cases and should. They give us motivation to really understand and deeply explore this problem. They also point out one other very important aspect of diagnostic error, which is that when there is a miss that results in a serious harm, such as a loss of life, as in this other video about Jess, who had a missed cardiac diagnosis, families and patients want to hear sorry. They want to have an apology, and they want that apology to manifest an actual improvement. They want the system to learn. And so it's on us to try to figure that out and share their motivation. But just thinking about stories, what the medical professionals sometimes called cases, and grabbing clues from those isn't enough to solve this problem. As I said earlier on, you know, we need patients and patient advocates as a community to partner on this problem. And to end up there is the real challenge. How do we go from a spot where we know that patients have stories, we know they're serious, we know this is a big problem, to being able to have people, the public, see this as an important enough issue to tackle and to work towards tackling it with their own experiences? The Society to Improve Diagnosis in Medicine has been mentioned. I'm involved in the patient engagement community with Helen Haskell, who is another person who's been affected by diagnostic error with the loss of her son to a diagnostic error. And we've been working to try to get those people who have their own stories and medical professionals to try to deepen the understanding of this issue and try to figure out how to take action. And so I asked that group that's still very much, in the early stages of development, what they thought the most important take-homes were from the report. And they've sort of brought into focus four areas. So first of all, the scope of the problem. In the game of life, it's very common to have a diagnostic error. And it can have serious consequences. So we've been hearing about that, and that was important to this community. The second area that was emphasized is that the feedback system about diagnosis is sorely lacking. This is a picture of the game Madden, a video game that some of you may know. The video game producer is very interested in user experience and uses that to keep updating the current version and make it better and better for the user experience and more able to represent and simulate the actual game. And we just don't have a system like that around diagnostic mistakes. In fact, we have the very human problem of feedback about diagnostic mistakes when they do happen, really feeling very badly to the clinicians who've been involved in some way. And that's a difficulty that's natural, and yet contemporary psychology has made it clear that learning comes from mistakes, and it's important to be able to know what those mistakes are. So we could learn more about that. The third area that the group highlighted is that good teamwork is absolutely vital. It's actually surprising that good teamwork isn't a goal until it was raised more clearly in the report. The entire team means the family and the patient as well, and that it's important to be able to reach out to those with enough expertise and bring them into the team, closer collaboration with pathologists and radiologists. The fourth is probably the real highlight is the idea of the patient having a role. Unlike in the game of Operation, patients' roles have to be more than just buzzing and lighting their noses when something goes wrong. The role of the patient in diagnosis is pretty murky. It's definitely not just buzzing and, you know, lighting up, but it's not exactly clear. It's that initial question I asked, can patients themselves improve diagnosis and prevent diagnostic error? What can patients do? We're in a time frame where there's more engagement of patients. The idea of partnership is becoming more salient, but thinking about that in this diagnostic space is brand new, really. The idea of letting patients know that they could seek a second opinion, that they can ask tough questions, that they don't have to worry about being seen as difficult, those are new areas. The idea of access to their diagnostic tests, the clinician's notes, all areas that are very much current and developing. So while prioritizing these four areas is a good start for the patient community, the terrain for patient partnership isn't very stable, and the challenges are incredibly complex. It's a lot like playing chess on this wobbly chessboard surface. There's no organization that acts solely on the public's behalf to take on this issue. None. Yet patients are an untapped resource well on this issue. We need people within the healthcare system to create the ways that partnership could exist in terms of trying to prevent diagnostic error. And as the Lundberg Institute's platform states, doctors and patients together have enormous power, and that power is derived from the trust that patients and physicians place in each other. We're at a special moment after this report where we need physicians, patients, and others in the healthcare field to work together in partnership on solutions at three levels. So at the bedside or the encounter level, figuring out how patients can partner in the diagnostic journey in that process that Beth described is the first level of potential partnership that needs to be worked out. The second level, where you have multiple people going through their own diagnostic mazes, would be the organizational level, the potential to involve patients in error disclosures and other efforts to improve the diagnostic process, engaging them in patient and family advisory committees and having those committees have this issue on their agenda is another possibility. At the third level, how can we make sure to invite patients into policy discussions related to, say, medical liability, different payment methods, research funding priorities? These are not worked out, but important. Commitment will be needed too. I was lucky enough to hear the patient safety guru, Peter Pronovost, speak at a conference 5 years ago when I believe he was just really starting to recognize that diagnostic error is a patient safety issue. He was telling the story of a young girl who lost her life in the hospital in a way that he realized actually was related to a failure in diagnosis. And after he told that story, he's one of these inspirational speakers and he likes to sort of get people acting. He asked us all to write down what we could do to help keep that from happening again. And I actually wrote down, I will help get patient and family perspective into diagnostic error, patient safety research. And I was thinking about that boy and girl with Ewing sarcoma that I talked about at the beginning. So I invite you to think about your own stories and write down your game plan for helping with this issue. Now Irma Mala will give us more of the physician perspective.
Hi everyone, thanks for hanging in with the final speaker. I know that's always a challenge. I'm very pleased to be with you today. I don't have slides to share with you. I want to just speak with you about, as a primary care physician and a researcher in this area, how I came to this field and how I feel the report advances the science and how we can bring that back into everyday practice. So because I'm a primary care physician, I have to start with a case. And this is a real case. This is one of my patients from my training days as a UCSF internal medicine resident. This patient of mine, who I'll call Mrs. S, came in to see me for a routine visit, and she had a knee replacement planned. We spoke about her upcoming surgery and her other health issues, and I scheduled her to be seen back in 3 months so I could see how her rehabilitation was proceeding. Mrs. S came back to see me in 3 months, and I was quite surprised to see that she was still using her cane. And so I asked her, Mrs. S, what happened with your knee replacement? And she said, oh, Dr. Sarkar, it was canceled. And I said, why was it canceled? Well, they did a chest x-ray. And I have to pause and tell you, it is not an evidence-based practice, and it was not an evidence-based practice 10 years ago when this happened, to do a chest x-ray before a knee replacement. So it was nowhere on my radar that such a test would have happened. They did a chest x-ray, and it showed a spot on my lungs, so they canceled the surgery. At this point in the visit, my blood pressure began to go up, and I tracked down the chest x-ray. Okay, we'll try this again. So I tracked down the chest x-ray. It did, in fact, show a suspicious spot on her lung. I investigated who had seen this chest x-ray, and I saw that the radiologist had documented that a doctor I'll call Dr. X was informed. Dr. X was the ordering physician for the chest x-ray. Dr. X was the intern rotating through the orthopedic service that month. He had taken an action. He had canceled Mrs. S's surgery. He had not taken any other action. I went with my attending physician to discuss with the radiologist to look at the actual film, which was then a film, and we ordered a CT scan that day for Mrs. S and diagnosed her lung cancer 2 days later. And this event is really what started my work in this area. I'm very, very lucky that Mrs. S's cancer was caught before it had spread, and she was successfully treated, and I actually saw her just last month, 10 years after we made this diagnosis. When I talk about Mrs. S's case, as I do quite frequently when I give my academic talks, I always ask the physicians in the room if this could happen to them today in 2015. I don't know how many physicians we have in the room, but I can tell you that there are always many who raise their hands. This is a vulnerability that has not gone away. And that's really what motivates me in this work. Now, with that, I want to turn to the report. I'm not going to discuss all of the recommendations in detail. And when I think of the report, I see sort of a dividing line between the most immediately actionable recommendations, which are the first four, and the more aspirational recommendations, which will require significant health policy changes. So I am going to talk about the recommendations that I feel are actionable for me as a primary care physician in my practice today. So that first recommendation is teamwork. We have already started transforming primary care and relying on our nurses and medical assistants and front desk staff to have larger roles than they ever have in the past. And I'll give you an example. My medical assistant recently saw one of my patients, meaning saw walking by in the clinic, they said hello to each other, and this patient of mine was complaining about having a lot of unresolved pain. So my assistant overbooked the patient into my clinic. I wasn't reachable because I was traveling, and so she went ahead and did it. That is not something that a medical assistant would typically do. I would control my schedule and how many patients I could see. With that increasing responsibility or that increasing reliance on teams, we as physicians also have to accept that we may be seeing an extra patient because of someone else's judgment. And I can tell you that although that occasionally can feel burdensome, that it is very patient-centered and a practice that really needs to spread. The other flip side of that is there are many things that physicians do in primary care that don't actually need to be done by physicians, and I'll give you an example. If someone has an abnormal mammogram, there is a very clear guideline-based set of actions that need to occur for follow-up of that abnormal mammogram. It is certainly a diagnostic risk when people have an abnormal screening mammogram. That is a vulnerability that people will not come back and get the full workup that they need. But we can have someone else on the team besides me keep the running list of who has done that follow-up and who has not, and call patients and understand why they may not go to the follow-up test they need, and then report back to me on the cases that actually require my input. That is an example of team-based care that can improve diagnosis. The second recommendation is education. And as many of you know, medical education is focused on acquiring a very large body of knowledge. But there's really good data from the learning sciences that suggests there is a way of thinking that promotes diagnosis. Diagnosis is not retrieving something from a body of knowledge. It's a cognitive process. And very little of medical education is focused on that cognitive process. I have another example for you. I recently took my internal medicine recertification exam, which was a 10-hour multiple choice examination. And I can tell you that it in no way improved my skills as a diagnostician. We on the committee feel that has to change. There are really good evidence-based ways to improve people's diagnostic thinking, and they need to become fundamental across all health professions education from the time that people start their training all the way through continuing education. Okay, the third recommendation is health information technology. And I want to ask the audience, how many of you have noticed a change in your interaction with your doctor since he or she started using an electronic health record? Right? So pretty much everyone. Current electronic health records, and I'm telling you this as a user, are not very usable. It takes a great deal of cognitive load for me to figure out which boxes to check, which tabs to open, and how to get the right information in the right place. There are a lot of reasons that that's a problem for diagnosis. So I might be missing my patient's cues. If I'm looking at the screen and I'm not looking at my patient, I might miss the nuance of what they're trying to communicate to me. And certainly there are many sensitive issues that don't come to light in primary care without a real face-to-face engagement. You may have seen the patient page in the Journal of the American Medical Association that was a child's drawing of the pediatrician. And it showed a man, a little stick figure, sitting in front of the computer. So this is really changing the way we interact, and I think the consequences on diagnosis should not be underestimated. Another consequence is there's less time. It is burdensome to document in the current electronic health record. And if I'm spending my several hours after clinic documenting, it's less time that I'm looking up those slightly concerning diagnoses that I need to be spending more time thinking about. And finally, there is the problem of burnout in primary care. There was a huge wave of early retirements right around the time that electronic health record implementation happened. And it continues to be a problem that there's attrition of primary care providers at all levels, partly because the work has become challenging moment to moment. And if we need to have a cadre of excellent diagnosticians, we need to support providers to avoid burnout. Beth mentioned that there is a very clear set of recommendations around improving these systems. We know what to do, and it has not been happening. And so I would call on all of you to think about how there can be pressure brought to bear on policymakers to really insist that these tools become usable and foster health. The last of the four recommendations that I'm going to talk about today is feedback. right now, there is no mechanism for me as a primary care physician to flag a diagnostic challenge to then go back and see if I was right. And most of the master clinicians who I've learned from at UCSF and who I try to emulate have some sort of a system. It might be a note card or a piece of paper or a Word file where they keep track of the people they want to go back to. And I have made it my practice when I see a patient in urgent care for one of my colleagues to then follow up with them and say, I saw your patient for an urgent issue. Was I right? How did the patient do? But this relies on my conscientiousness and is not a solution for primary care writ large. There are no good reporting mechanisms that are widely used by physicians to focus on these challenging diagnoses. If someone makes an error, in most settings, the error reporting mechanisms are focused on processes and are much more likely to be used by other healthcare providers rather than physicians. As Kathy mentioned, physicians experience a lot of heartache over missed or delayed diagnoses. Dr. Albert Wu has actually coined the term second victim to describe what happens to physicians after they make an adverse event. It can be life-changing. There needs to be a way within our medical systems that physicians can acknowledge that everyone, if every patient is going to experience a diagnostic error, every physician is going to make a diagnostic error. And this has to be normalized and has to be accepted. The way that we've tried to do this at San Francisco General and UCSF, where I practice, is through our morbidity and mortality conference. This is a very common and classic mechanism to discuss challenging cases. And our attempt at culture change has been by encouraging our most senior and respected physicians to share their diagnostic errors. And I can tell you that this models for trainees more than any number of grand rounds I could put on or talks that I could give the normalization of these errors. So I do think, despite the gloom and doom about diagnostic errors, that there are many things that can be done right now in the context of primary care and of medical practice more broadly to improve the situation. I think the common theme in all the actions I've talked about is very clear. None of them can be done by only physicians. They all require partners. Partners, first and foremost, with our patients and their families, but also with other healthcare professions and with each other to engage in a different way, to truly be putting the patient front and center and moving constantly towards improvement in diagnosis, which is job one. Thank you.
Yeah, I was going to ask you all to clap for everybody. I think they did a really good job. Sweet. How many of you, if you care to share, have experienced personally, yourself or in your family, a serious diagnostic error? Anybody? One person? Two people? Well, you guys need to be a little more alert. I think from hearing all three of you, I think we're all swimming in the scourge of unintended consequences. We have done so many things that we thought we were doing right, and it turned out it has so many things that happen. The electronic medical record, we all thought for years and years was going to be a solution to a lot of things, and it solves some things, but it's also creates so many more problems that should have been foreseen, and maybe they were, but we're really in a mess with that one. And every doctor knows that and says it and is trying to work on it. The examination that the doctor referred to is called the MOC, Maintenance of Certification, and this, its extent, its irrelevance to the practice of proper medicine has produced a giant backlash, and even to the point of physicians virtually refusing to do it and creating societies that will be parallel to it and trying to throw out the main boards of internal medicine because they've made this thing happen. And there's a very large backlash. Now, I know the people who made it happen, and they didn't intend to cause trouble. They thought they were doing the right thing, but a lot of people disagree. Our Mr. Moderator Superior, how many minutes do we have until our radio audience is supposed to clear out? 4 minutes, all right? Questions from anyone in the audience for our panel? Yes, sir. Would you speak into a microphone? I will bring it to you.
Thank you for your various points. But as laymen or patients, sometimes we're confused between hearing, you know, the points that you just made versus, for example, reading recently about the issue of overdiagnosis, mentioning, for example, in the case of breast cancer diagnosis, the article even encouraged that you do not do further tests that could be unnecessary and so on and so forth. Now, so we can't decide whether or not that comment is aimed at a very broad population, may not apply to specific cases or narrower cases. So when you make the point about delayed diagnosis, and then you compare that to a decision to not to go further tests as recommended by some doctors, then, you know, it is a mental struggle as to how, which way we should go.
So, well, let me just try to say something about overdiagnosis, and again, this is definitional. So the committee defined overdiagnosis as a condition that would not affect the health and well-being of a patient. So it's identifying a problem, but not one that would be expected to affect the length of life or the quality of life. This is often been talked about, for instance, with screening for prostate cancer, where more men die with prostate cancer than of prostate cancer. The reason overdiagnosis is a concern is that it leads to often treatment that has more harms attached to it than benefits. We didn't view overdiagnosis as a diagnostic error. It's actually a correct diagnosis. It's just one that doesn't that doesn't actually shouldn't affect sort of subsequent actions. And so I think there is a difference between trying to figure out how much additional information has to be taken. And it's really gathering the information, I should probably let Irma Mala answer this, that would help decide on a course of action that is going to affect the quality and quantity of life in a way that makes sense for a patient's preferences. So I think we try to set overdiagnosis aside as something that is kind of too much attention to something that's really not going to make a difference. And that's different than getting the right information that helps identify actions that can be taken that will have a positive impact on a patient's health. I don't know if that's clear.
And I'll just add that I think that the ingredient here to help you help you as a patient think about overdiagnosis versus getting the appropriate care that you need and advocating for yourself is communication and trust. So if you have a primary care provider with whom you have a long-term relationship and that person understands your values and preferences and you have a mutually trusting relationship, then you can come to an individualized decision that is appropriate. And a lot of the literature that we reviewed asked physicians what they think are essential conditions for diagnostic accuracy. And one that comes up over and over again is continuity, right? So having the same physician or other healthcare provider over time who knows you as a person helps with the communication piece, and also as a physician helps me, because when my patients, who I've known for a long time, come and see me and something is different, I know. And so that helps me know, this time I am going to insist that they get a chest x-ray and a chest CT for their cough, because I know this is someone who doesn't slow down if they just have a run-of-the-mill infection. I know them better. So I would advocate for continuity and communication as the answer there.
Any other questions? We have time for one more.
First of all, thank you to the panel for a very informative session. With technology, and this follows on a bit from the previous question, there's ability for the patient to do a lot of research on the internet and come up with their own diagnosis of what they have. and in many ways probably out of fear or whatever, overdiagnose themselves. How do you deal with that situation with the current technology?
I'll take a stab at that. I encountered that this very morning. And I think that physicians have this automatic panic reaction when someone comes in with a stack of papers they've printed from the internet. And I have personally really tried to shift my thinking on that. And what I start with when people come in with that stack of papers is I tell them, I am so glad that you are prioritizing your health in this way. That allows us to start the conversation in a very different place. And usually, there is something behind the reason that they're coming to me with stacks of paper. It might be a family history they haven't disclosed yet. It might be that they have a symptom that they haven't been comfortable sharing to this point, or perhaps a behavior that they haven't told me about. And so I always try to frame it as, what is behind this big stack of papers or this internet searching?
And I would add, too, that I've heard from a number of patients who have used their research to good outcome. Yes. In terms of actually finding material that their doctor wasn't aware of. And the problem is actually how that conversation gets started. That's the challenge.
Great. There was one other question. I think we can slide it in.
Yeah, first of all, thank you. Excellent report, super presentations. But I'm mulling over this teamwork, team sport, diagnosis of a team sport issue. My experience is that my primary care physician is the one that I go to for diagnosis, and she's the one who makes the diagnosis. And, you know, in settings like yours at UCSF, or actually where I go, there are medical assistants that help, and I, you know, that I can understand as team, but I don't understand a broader team concept than that. And it leads me to wonder if it wouldn't have been good to have more of a focus on the role of the primary care physician in dealing with these issues in your report.
I think that's really challenging. I mean, I think we had a committee with representation from radiology and pathology and human factors and, you know, kind of a nice broad swath of perspectives. And so part of that teamwork is actually using the expertise of the specialists. And sometimes that's how the primary care doctor does that, what's going on interprofessionally. Sometimes that has to do with the patients having access to information and asking for it to be more closely looked at by more of the members of the team.
And I would say that the, you know, diagnoses range from very simple things, colds and flu, to very complex and rare things. And the size and the complexity of the team varies as the complexity of the diagnosis and the challenge in making the diagnosis changes. And so, you know, for a lot of things, one person is maybe going to be the one who makes most diagnoses. You're basically healthy. And so you may not need to go further than that. But, you know, if you think about the lab tests that get ordered or imaging tests that may get ordered, there are other people behind the scenes that are reading and interpreting those. You're not aware they're on the team. And in fact, what we've learned in much of the research is they're not actively engaged in the team in a way that helps them, for starters, be a consultant to the doctor around what tests even should be ordered. What do they hope to learn? I just went through this with my mother last week where, you know, I said, asked her to ask the doctor, why am I having this test? What is it you hope to learn? How will it affect my treatment? So and so there were a lot of people on the team trying to figure out what was wrong with her. And, you know, what we called on was the need in those circumstances to make sure that they're all communicating and that they're doing it in a way that enables them to kind of collectively come to the best decision. But I don't think it's always the case that there are 15 or 20 people trying to do that. Sometimes it's one or two, and sometimes it's, you know, 20 or 30. So I think we were just trying to make sure that the teams can expand and contract as necessary to deal with the diagnoses that are simpler or more difficult.
Great. Well, first, that was excellent. And I thought one of the interesting ideas for me was the idea of changing the pricing on the consults with the radiologist and everything, and also on your conscientiousness. My wife is a doctor. And it seems to me if the system is set up with incentives that push against the conscientiousness, you don't get any time value for all that extra time that's spent, then all the conscientious doctors will still be conscientious because that's their character. But you don't encourage anybody else to be, and that's the problem. And so I think that's a great thing to put the pricing as a lawyer, you know, put the pricing in, you know, to the system. You know.
And the conscientious ones burn out sometimes.
And the conscientious ones burn out because they do so much, and there's actually some disincentives, you know, to say, oh, you spent too much time on this. Stop paying so much attention to your patients. You know, well, it happens. It happens in every field. It's been, you know, the accountants, but it's really useful to have the accountants and make it work. But if you tell them to put the pricing in of the good incentives. What's the problem with that? Lawyers charge for every second that they talk. Anyway, so thank you very much for coming. And it was a great panel, a great way to announce the thing. And I want to thank George Lundberg and the Lundberg Institute for, again, another great event every year. Now for 5 years we've been doing this. And I'm sure we'll do it again next year. So thank you very much for coming. And so ends. So ends another event at the Commonwealth Club. It's the 113th year of enlightened discussion. Thank you.